Protégé Podcast, the career advice, inspiration, and truth you need for your career journey.
Hi, my name is Jordan. You should listen to my dad's podcast. Bye.
I'm Rory Verrett. Welcome to Protégé Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. Happy New Year, everyone. It's 2017. Finally, thank goodness we put 2016 to bed. What a year. A lot of ups and downs, more downs than up. And we're not even going to go through all the challenges because we're starting anew, inspired, motivated, renewed, refreshed. We're going to make 2017 the year we accomplish more of our goals and resolutions than ever. So I won't bore you with my resolutions, all of them, but one of them is to grow Protégé Podcast even better than we did last year. And last year we had an incredible year. 15,000 downloads of Protégé Podcast. An amazing, amazing testament to all of your support of the podcast and some of the great ideas you provided and this community we are building to help each other share some best practices, some insights, even some secrets about how to have an extraordinary career, how to start your entrepreneurial career, how to get that promotion, how to increase your output at work, how to be more efficient and productive, and how to become the best leader you can be. That's what we're trying to achieve here on Protégé Podcast. So thank you for taking the journey with me. And I want to give a shout out to listeners across the globe. I've looked at my dashboard here on SoundCloud, and I'm trying to figure out all the countries that have listened to 10 or more episodes of Protégé Podcast in the last year. 10 or more episodes. There are 16 countries outside of the United States that have downloaded 10 or more episodes. The United Kingdom, Spain, Australia, Canada, Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden, France, Senegal, Japan, Mexico, Singapore, Belgium, Brazil, and Colombia. 16 countries in addition to the United States where listeners have downloaded more than 10 episodes. So thank you from Potomac, Maryland, here in the United States, for taking the journey with us on Protégé Podcast and listening to the show consistently. Also on the dashboard, I want to give a shout out to my listeners in the top 10 cities in America who have downloaded Protégé Podcast. Number one, Washington, D.C., my second home after New Orleans. Number two, New York, Atlanta, New Orleans, the Bronx, New York, Dallas, Texas, Houston, Texas, Brooklyn, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles. So we are stretching across the globe. And number 12 is Chicago. So lest we think we're only on the coasts and in the south, we are all over the United States. So thank you so much. We're going to have so much fun this year. We've got so many exciting guest mentors lined up, so many different and innovative show ideas. So a lot's coming down the pike. Thank you so much for staying with us at Protégé Podcast. On today's episode, Melanie Newman. How many of you watch Scandal and look at Kerry Washington's character as a crisis communications expert embroiled in all these scandals, and she finds a way to sort of get through and navigate the political treachery that is Washington? Melanie Newman has lived a life maybe not as ridiculously complex and dramatic as what Kerry Washington lives in her character on Scandal, but she's lived a real life version where she has been a witness to history in some amazing moments and has lived to tell about it and is going to share several stories of incredible moments you've read about in the news. And she was a seat at the table navigating through it. Situations like the 2008 presidential election, the financial crisis, the housing crisis, the BP oil spill, working at the Justice Department with the U.S. Attorney General when some of these police shootings have happened with unarmed black men. Melanie Newman started her career working in controversy and learning crisis communications the hard way. So up next on Protégé Podcast, Melanie Newman is a witness to history. I'm so happy to welcome the Protégé Podcast, somebody I've known since she was, Melanie, I'm going to say 12 years old. You will always be little Melanie to me. And now you're like a grown, accomplished, incredibly talented and credentialed crisis communications executive, but you're always going to be Norman's little sister, Melanie Newman from the White House and the Justice Department and the DNC. And I'm gonna let you get into it, but Melanie Newman, welcome to Protégé Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I love the podcast and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. So I always tell people, they're like, how do you know all these people? Melanie's brother, Norman, and my brother are best friends. And so I've known you since you were in junior high.
I feel like it was, well, you may have known me as a baby. Mm-hmm. and then I reemerged as a junior high schooler.
That's correct.
Because that is the experience with, because we moved. And so mm-hmm. Norman's little sister was 8 or 5. And then she came back and she was a teenager. Oh, and then goodness. You see me again. And now I'm an adult.
You see, it makes you feel old when young people are now getting older. That's not right? good. That's not good for my sense of youth. I need to hang around old people so I feel like the young person. But good Lord. So I'm not going to hype you up, Melanie, but people will toss this sort of expression around. Oh, this person is like Olivia Pope because of scandal, right? They're a crisis communications executive. You kind of really are like an Olivia Pope, with the one exception that President Obama is not like the crazy president on scandal. In fact, he's been scandal free. Fist pound to President Obama. Love you, bruh. Melanie, we start all of our episodes the same way. Tell us where you're from and how you grew up.
So I'm originally from New Orleans, like you. Mm-hmm. Our brothers are best friends. My parents, my brother is 13 years older than me. So mm-hmm. when he went to college, he started at Howard the same year I started kindergarten. My parents moved to Alabama. So I also grew up in Alabama for part of the time, which is why I disappeared. You may have known me when I was young and then I reappeared in high school.
Right.
And then I went to college in Tallahassee, Florida, at Florida A&M University, which, as you know, sits on the highest of 7 hills in Tallahassee, Florida, goodness. Founded in 1887.
You're kind of saying that as if I go to a rival HBCU.
You know that Rattlers are the most obnoxious of the HBCU grads.
Yes.
shout out to all of my FAMU Lee who are listening today.
All 3 of them. No, I'm kidding. Continue, please.
So I went to college in Tallahassee, mm-hmm. and I have essentially been living in Washington ever since. I went back and forth between Washington and New Orleans a little bit in my adult life, but mm-hmm. I was in Tallahassee from 1997 to 2001, which means I was there for the 2000 election, which I think certainly triggered my interest in politics, mm-hmm. and was the site of my first crisis communications experience.
Tell us a little bit about that. That was Bush v. Gore. The election dragged on a little while. The Supreme Court had to eventually settle it. What was it like right there at the scene?
Right. So I was communications director for student government at the time. Hmm. And the election happened. We don't have a winner. The night of the election, everyone goes to sleep. The votes are still being counted. We wake up the next morning. We don't have a winner. And the student government started getting a flood of people saying they didn't get to vote on election day.
Wow.
And we started taking complaints, and it was well over 500 people giving all kinds of reasons, roadblocks. I had two different voter cards and no location had me on their rolls. Mm. I didn't get my registration card until after the election. I was told to go to one place, then I was sent to another place. Lots of different reasons.
Oh my goodness.
For FAMU students in particular,
mm-hmm.
which, as you know, FAMU is an HBCU. At the time, I think there were 13,000 students at the university. So if you want to limit Black voters in Tallahassee, FAMU is certainly a place where you might target your efforts. So we decided a couple days after the election that we were going to march on the Capitol. And we did. There's a funny scene in the movie Recount where you see some Black students with tape over their mouths. I don't remember if we actually had tape over our mouths, but we called it a silent march and said that we were marching in silence to protest the way our voices were silenced in the election. And we had two spokespeople, the president of the Student Government Association and the Senate president, who, as it would happen, is now the mayor of Tallahassee, Florida. And I was running them around, setting them up for interviews with CNN. Every news organization in the country was in Tallahassee at the time. And so all we had to do was get to the Capitol and walk from news truck to news truck. And so that was my first foray into national news for sure. And then over the next few weeks, we had members of Congress coming to Tallahassee holding events on our campus. And I was getting national press for those events. And it was that experience that introduced me to Washington politics. A press secretary for Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson came up to me at one of the events and said, "You need to be in Washington. You should intern and you should apply for the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation internship." And I did. And I applied to work in the office of my hometown congressman, Congressman William Jefferson.
Okay.
And so my last summer in college, I was in Washington interning on the Hill. And I have almost been in Washington ever since.
Bill Jefferson is not just your hometown congressman. he was investigated and indicted and convicted and is now in federal prison for corruption. He was the long-term congressman from New Orleans. I used to work for him. I did the internship. I got the Congressional Black Caucus internship many years ago and worked on his staff as well. So you're working for a member of Congress who is under investigation, and there was an FBI raid of his office and his house while you worked for him. What was that like?
I'll back up just a little bit. I went to work for him initially as his staff assistant. So I was answering the phones, opening mail. I went to him one day. I said, "Look, Congressman, I'm losing brain cells. I can't do this job anymore. I really want to do a press job." He said, "Well, I know of one. You could go work for the DA in New Orleans. You know, I can help you with that." So I became the public information director for Eddie Jordan, who was the first Black DA in New Orleans ever. The first new DA in 30 years. He was replacing Harry Connick Sr. Eddie Jordan ended up leaving office in disgrace also, sadly. I had left his office before that, but there were several crises in the DA's office up to that point. Jamie Foxx got into a fight in Harris Casino, and we prosecuted him and his sister for that. There were several witnesses that were shot. I had some experience with with crisis situations in a law enforcement context. So I want to mention this because it sort of explains my reaction to when I was told the congressman's house was being raided. So it was during the congressional recess. It was August 3rd, 2005. So I'll never forget the date. And during recess, congressional staff come in a trickle. So I arrived in the office around 10:30 in the morning. And because everything is slower, the members are not in town typically. And my colleague says, "Melanie, I need you to sit down. I need to talk to you about something." I thought he was going to tell me the congressman was dead because he looked so somber. And he said, this morning, federal agents raided the congressman's houses in Washington and New Orleans. They are in the parking lot right now in his car. We don't know what's happening or why they are raiding the houses and the vehicles. We don't know if he is the subject of an investigation or a part of an investigation of someone else. But you need to call his lawyer and coordinate with his attorney on how we will deal with media inquiries.
Okay, let's take a mini pause right there. How old are you this day?
26 years old.
Oh my goodness.
I was a baby.
26 years old and a fairly significant, complex, what turns out to be legally very relevant and impactful. This is all such a moment really of history. I mean, it's historic in Louisiana politics. It's historic in the history of, you know, congressional Black caucus members. Were you ever in this moment afraid, nervous, felt like I'm not ready to deal with this?
No, my immediate reaction was, whew, you mean he's alive? and I said, I know how to deal with this. We don't have to say anything. We don't know what's happening. So my answer to reporters is no comment. We don't talk about ongoing investigations. Because that was my answer in the DA's office. And even though I was on the other side, I knew there's lots of stuff that, that happens in an investigation where he could be under investigation and nothing comes of it. And so at that point, it was not time to worry. And so I connected with his attorney. We drafted a statement and I was like, everybody calm down. It's totally fine. He could be under investigation. He also could not be. We just don't know. It's not, this happens. And so we will be fine. I, at 26 years old, for some reason, was the voice of reason at that moment.
Sounds like you were the adult in the room.
And, you know, I just went to work. And every day after that, I went to work. And we started getting inundated with calls and questions and what does this mean? What is... And as over time I have learned, the FBI has a tendency to do, information was leaking out about the investigation. But we maintained no comment. We don't have any information. As luck would have it, 3 weeks later, Hurricane Katrina hit. The storm happens, and now we have a situation where the congressman is he is a senior member of the delegation. He is on the Powerful Ways and Means Committee. He has power to do something for the people of New Orleans. And you can, the investigation aside, there was a need, an incredible need at the time for in reinvestment to bring people back home. And so we went to work. And I worked very hard to get reporters in our office. I had reporters in our office watching. We were doing constituent services in the Washington office, which you worked on the Hill. That doesn't happen because every congressional member has a local office. Our local office was closed because the people who worked in the local office were displaced. The city was shut down. We were taking FEMA complaints. We were reporting missing people for the Red Cross. We were, in addition to drafting legislation to deal with the response, we were, the Congressman Jefferson flew on Air Force One with President Bush four times to the district. You know who didn't fly on Air Force One with George Bush? Bobby Jindal, who was also a member of Congress and a Republican member of Congress. But President Bush and Congressman Jefferson had worked together on trade deals. They had a relationship. So William Jefferson was working for the district, and that gave us something else to talk about, something positive and something that was salient in the news at the time. And so people would ask about the investigation, and I would remind him, reporters aren't doing their jobs if they don't ask you about this investigation. You have to answer the question, but you have something to pivot to. Turn back to the work you're doing in the district. So we did every national interview that came in, mm-hmm. because that was the only way he was going to be able to communicate with his constituents, because none of them were in New Orleans anymore.
Okay.
So he was on the Today Show, Good Morning America. He was on every national news outlet that called. I even put him on Hannity, which I regret. And if I was not 26, I wouldn't have made that mistake.
Nobody's perfect. But Nobody's perfect. I will say.
You learn.
That's right. And I will say, just to set the record straight, when you say we, I mean, you're being a little modest. There is not a 20-person press team in a congressional office. There's like you and like a couple of people that are helping. And many times just you.
It was just me, actually. Oh, wow. When I say we, I mean me and William Jefferson, basically. Mm. We were the strategic press team. and then, you know, so we are working every day. And I remember I had pitched this, I had been pitching Stephanie Grace, who was a columnist for the Times-Picayune, mm-hmm. on how hard William Jefferson was working for the district. And mm-hmm. yes, he's under investigation, but look at all the work look at everything he's accomplished. Mm-hmm. And she finally writes a column in April of 2006 with William Jefferson's face on the Energizer Bunny. It's a little cartoon. And I had it for the longest, like pinned up to my cubicle wall, mm-hmm. because it was like my life's work in this column, just about how productive he had been, mm-hmm. despite this investigation. Mm-hmm. And the very next day, the first witness pled guilty in connection with the investigation against him, mm-hmm. and the tide turned. Mm-hmm. It became a serious thing that we could no longer just no comment. And so, you know, we had been doing along the way press conferences when there were things that happened in the case, but there was a long stretch of time when nothing happened in the case that gave us the opportunity to talk about other things. But once that person pled guilty, we didn't have that opportunity anymore. And then another person pled guilty. And then the FBI raided the congressman's office in Washington. Mm-hmm. And we entered a constitutional crisis.
And again, just to give background context, not to give complete context, because you can read about this on the internet. There are hundreds of stories and articles about it. But essentially, the congressman was involved in a scheme that involved a staffer in his D.C. office, officials in the Nigerian government, an African-American business owner, and a Caucasian woman business owner, and a bunch of different deals mm-hmm. being cut that were bribes and corrupt and whatnot. It was a very complicated scheme. And you're in the middle of this, so you've got a couple of tensions at play. You've got... this is sort of your second or third job. So you're in the early part of your career. You're learning all this stuff in real time. This is your boss that's under investigation. It's not like it's, you know, it's you work at HUD and the president's being investigated. This is your boss like 10 feet away from your office that's being investigated. Your hometown and your house and your family are all vulnerable and relocating and trying to get to literally firm, dry land after Katrina. And you're at the ripe old age of 26, 27, trying to manage all of this. I got to ask you, what did you lean on to keep you steady? Your faith, friends, your family? What literally kept you focused during the storm?
The work. Mm-hmm. So the other crazy thing, my first day of graduate school was also August 29th, 2005.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, it's first day, everybody goes around and introduces themselves and you have to say where you're from. And I'm like, I'm from New Orleans. And everybody's like, aw.
Oh, man.
So I was too busy to stop and think about it. There was too much going on. There was too much work to do. And the congressman was more than just my hometown congressman. He might as well have been a family member. I grew up with his daughter, Jelani. I went to school with her. I had been to sleepovers at his house. His wife and my father worked together for a long time. I knew him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing because I knew him, it took me a very long time to believe that he could have done anything absolutely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. never talked about it, because what happens when your boss is under investigation, there's an office called the House of Representatives Counsel's Office.
Mm-hmm.
And these are attorneys who represent the staff or the office and give guidance and counsel to staff. They do other things, but one of the things they do is give guidance and counsel to staff mm-hmm. in the event of mm-hmm. something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so the day, I guess it was the day they raided the house, they came to us and said, any conversation you have with the member about what's happening will make you a witness to the case. So be very careful. And I took that to heart.
Mm.
I had no intention of going to court to testify.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never asked him any questions. Mm-hmm. And I only remember one time him attempting to, or seeming like he was going to go in that direction in the mm-hmm. conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't want to hear anymore.
Mm.
As far as I'm concerned, that's not a conversation I want to hear. As far as I'm concerned, you didn't do anything. I don't know. But as far as I'm concerned, you didn't do anything. That's how I have to do my job. I just didn't believe it because I know him.
So let me ask you this. Could you have had a different approach to serving him in what is now a crisis communications role if you didn't have a high opinion of him? Not that you believed he was guilty, but if you just thought, you know, I don't really know. I don't know him that well. This is just some member from North Carolina I got a job with. I mean, would you have been as effective? Did your belief in him, you know, undergird the excellence and the work ethic you brought to the job?
Absolutely. I think that, and I was young and dumb. I mean, the congressman had a saying that he liked to keep young people around him because young people didn't know what they couldn't do.
Mm.
So if you asked them to bring home the rainbow, they would actually try to do it.
Mm-hmm. That's deep.
And so I was young and believed in him and was willing to go to the mat but I also think it at some point after Katrina, it also was about more than just him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the people of the district needed his seniority,
mm-hmm.
his talent and his understanding of the tax code and investment mechanisms to spur development and trade world to ensure that the Port of New Orleans was still viable. Like
mm-hmm.
he had with him an amount of institutional knowledge and understanding that the district needed. And I felt strongly that we needed to protect that.
Yes.
And so it was a belief in him, but it was also the district is in crisis. Like
mm-hmm.
I think the better question is, if Katrina hadn't happened, how long would I have stuck it out and how much would I have done to address that crisis? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. So it turns out that your initial sort of loyalty to mission, which is personal, and look, he's a BFD. He's a African-American member of Congress on the most powerful committee in the House. He's historic. He's the first African-American to represent Louisiana in Congress since like PBS Pinchback or something in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's the most powerful black politician in the state and one of the most powerful Democrats in the state, if not the most powerful Democrat in the state. But all of that shifts and it becomes really this, you know, allegiance to helping basically people of New Orleans that are looking for any help. I mean, you remember Ray Nagin's famous rant. Whatever you think about Ray Nagin, he is also in jail. He represented mm-hmm. the agony of people who felt like, you know, nobody is listening to us. Nobody is trying to help us. And his famous get your asses down here and do something. It sounds like you were in the bunker and that sort of the storm actually helped you get through both the PR with Katrina and the PR with Jefferson doing the investigation and bring your best self to these crises.
That's right. Because I was also, I owned a home in New Orleans. Totally, it was a total loss. My parents' home destroyed. My parents never went back. My brother's home was not destroyed, but had a significant amount of damage. The home that was my grandparents' home that we were using as a rental property had a significant amount of damage. My aunts and uncles were displaced. I was also a victim of the storm, too. And so I knew innately what the district needed because I was experiencing it as well.
That's unbelievable. And I'm going to ask you this in retrospect, not your state of mind then. Did you feel betrayed by him?
Not at the time, no. It took a long time to get there. Eventually, I did during the trial because his defense was, I think they did a half day defense. The prosecution had testimony going for like 25 days or something, and his defense was a half day. And the only thing he ever said to me was, "I have an honorable explanation." And I never heard it. I expected to hear it come out in trial, and I've never heard it.
And so, make a long narrative come to a conclusion. The congressman is convicted and is serving a sentence in federal prison.
The longest sentence of any member of Congress in the history of the country. 13 years.
13 years. And because there was a bit of a constitutional crisis, a sense of overreaching into the legislative branch and whatnot, you, I'm reading between the lines on your resume, I'm guessing you are armed now with some pretty incredible experience in a fairly nuanced area, and you go take that to the Committee on the Judiciary in the House as the communications director.
Right. I think I was also hired because at the time, Mr. Conyers was also under an ethics investigation.
I'm saying Olivia Pope.
I became the person who deals with members in crisis. But that ethics investigation resulted in nothing. But we then, the committee launched a major oversight investigation of the U.S. Justice Department a month after I joined. That resulted in the resignation of the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, and nearly a dozen of his senior staff. So I was there at a time when we were doing this incredible investigation, these hearings where testimony was like watching it was like watching Scandal, the testimony that was described in the hearing room. But yes, I had this unique experience working for William Jefferson that then led to me working for the House Judiciary Committee because I was the person who could help people in crisis.
And then if you are not merely a witness to history from Bush v. Gore in college, to a major investigation of a sitting member of Congress, to a major investigation of another sitting member of Congress on a committee. Now you are the Southern Regional Communications Director for Obama for America, the campaign in July 2008, just as the world is walking into the major financial crisis. And this is around Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and the financial fallout. Tell us how you got involved with the campaign and what that was like working in Chicago for those pivotal months.
So I had a grad school professor. I finally graduated from graduate school in May of 2008. And I had a professor who was friends with Anita Dunn, who was a senior advisor to the campaign, and mentioned me to her. And Anita said, "Oh, I have her resume." And she called me the next day. And I think maybe 2 weeks later, I was in Chicago. And I remember I was the Southern Regional Comms Director, as you mentioned. And the comms director, Dan Pfeiffer, said, "You know, you'll have Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida. The South is probably not going to be in play, so it shouldn't be a heavy lift for you. And I reminded him on election, the day before the election, mm-hmm. when Barack Obama, his three campaign stops on the day before election day were Virginia, South Carolina, and, or I think he did Florida, North mm-hmm. Carolina, and mm-hmm. Virginia in that mm-hmm. order. He ended the night in Virginia, that the South was not supposed to be in play.
That's right.
It was a remarkable experience. I mean, I can't even, I would look around the room sometimes and just be in awe of the fact that I was in this room with these incredibly smart people who had found a way to make a skinny guy with a funny name a black man mm-hmm. in America, mm-hmm. a contender for the president of the United States. It was, you know, I am from the South. I did not think that was possible.
That's right.
And every day I learn something new. And you mentioned the Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. I remember getting up to go to work that morning when it seemed like the world was coming to an end. Mm-hmm. And my reaction was, oh my God, do I want to work in the administration? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do I want to really be dealing with this? Like, we're finally possibly going to get a black president and this is what he has to deal with?
I mean,
with?
At this point.
Why, Jesus?
I mean, at this point in your career, you're like, can I just get a break? Can I just get a break? Katrina, indictments, folks going to jail. Now we got the world falling apart, the Great Recession in its infancy. And Obama is about to pick up that big legacy left for him.
Right.
And right. you're in a communications job having to explain again to the public something that is hard to explain.
Right. So, you know, during the campaign, I did not have to deal with that so much, mm-hmm. Because what people in Florida really cared about, which is the space program, mm-hmm. the I-4 corridor really cares about the space program. So I knew everything there was to know about the space program at the time. And in North Carolina, there were, you know, everything was sort of state specific, and that is where my focus was. But in the when he won the presidency and we are in the inaugural and I'm starting to think about where I want to work, somehow I ended up going to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, mm-hmm. which, and part of my calculus was, we are in the middle of a foreclosure crisis. Mm-hmm. That is where the work to address the crisis is going to be done.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. I sort of ran to the fire. So instead of like finding myself in the fire, I started to feel like that I wanted to, that was attractive to me now. I had been doing it for so long that I sought it out.
Do you find that you're more comfortable in it intellectually, or your skill set is just so valuable, or is it a combination of both?
I think it's probably a combination of both. At this point, I have dealt with so many different types of crises, mm-hmm. and over a period of time where the media landscape has changed. Mm-hmm. So when I was dealing with William Jefferson and Hurricane Katrina, Twitter didn't exist.
Hmm.
So the ways in which we communicated, like I think I mentioned, William Jefferson was on every single morning news show, and mm-hmm. he was doing all the TV requests that we had. That's because that is how people received news at mm-hmm. the time.
Mm-hmm.
That has changed dramatically over time, and Twitter was just becoming a major force in the news media around 2009, 2010. It was starting to grow and churn. And so I think it is a combination of like where I find comfort. Mm-hmm. It's always my reaction to something bad happening is the same as it was when they sat me down and said William Jefferson's house was being raided.
Mm-hmm.
I can deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
And that is valuable, because everybody else's hair is going to be on fire. Everybody else is going to be freaking out. So you need the person who can say, I can handle it. Here's what we're going to do.
And you have now the reps. I mean, so much in your career, it's about getting the reps and the experience in the function you serve so that you can say, this new thing is happening, it reminds me of this. And you can pull from your experiences and have some, you know, retrospective understanding of this worked then, it might work again now.
That's right.
And
it's like, yep, developing a muscle.
That's right. And you spend, you know, a good stretch at HUD, and then you work in the White House as Associate Director for Communications and Strategic Planning at the Office of Management and Budget. Doesn't take a Rhodes Scholar to understand that that's a pretty huge and complex job. So before we get into the in-depth conversation about your actual work, I just want to have you break it down a little bit about what it's like literally working in the White House for President Obama. I mean, give us, just as sort of psychological voyeurs, what that must have been like. Coming up on part two of my conversation with Melanie Newman, more of her experience working in the Obama administration and some of the lessons she's learned along the way. And on the breakdown, we talk about how we can apply these lessons to our own career journeys. Thank you for tuning in to Protégé Podcast. Please check us out on social media at Protégé Podcast on Facebook and Instagram, and let us know your thoughts on topics we can cover on the next Protégé Podcast.